I will. Severson?
Present.
Ward? Bynum? Skillings? Prysanka?
Present.
Otteson? Hagerman?
Here.
Okay, so we're still waiting on Mr. Ward. Yep, Jeremy, you're in. Okay. So we're still waiting on Mr. Skillings and Mr. Ward.
I'm here, sharing this clip. I get to call in. I do some work outside.
Oh, okay. And do we have Mr. Ward on the line now?
So,
no response, Mr. Chair.
So we have a quorum?
We do have a quorum, yes.
All right. So where we left off was 7AC, consideration and approval of resolution number 2021-080, adopting the vegetation management plan. Do I have a motion to put the resolution on the table?
Bob, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is there a written resolution, or are we just asking to put the resolution before us?
We have to have a motion in order to put it on for discussion and passage.
All right. I move to approve resolution number 2021-080.
Do I have a second?
Second.
It has been moved and seconded. Trey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess, Willer, the first place I'll start with this vegetation management plan is this took a lot of effort, a couple of years to gather data, and it took multiple staff to work various elements of it. So it really was a major team effort to get something put together. And I'll say my overall objective with this plan was to create a sustainable plan. We've historically dedicated chunks of money toward clearing, and it's generally been driven by flying the line, observing areas that needed attention, and trying to address those kind of on an annual year with a little bit of outlook, but not that far. And on top of that, some of our lines are maturing. So, when you first cut them for the initial installation of the line, you don't have to do much clearing on those for several years. But obviously the STI is coming of age, and certainly Swan and Tyee are already there. So, that's kind of the overarching, my objective with the plan. And so we undertook this, and we tried to put it in. I know it's pretty lengthy, and I'm not sure if everybody's had a chance to thoroughly review it. So I'll just kind of hit on a couple of the high points. I won't linger too long. I'll point out a couple of important areas. And first of all, vegetation management is the single largest O&M expense for most utilities. And virtually every major outage in the U.S., not every, but the majority outside of, natural disasters, a lot of the time it can be tied directly back to vegetation management. If you remember the big blackout they had on the East Coast here several years back, they did a whole bunch of research on that and testing and all this. And at the end of the day, it came down to poor vegetation management. So I'm just underscoring that, it is prudent to make major investments in your vegetation management plan, and it is prudent to be proactive. And up until this point, we'd be flying the line. We'd see where some of the trees were starting. You'd see the tops starting to, impinge and get a little corroded damage on top of them. And really, that's not where we want to be as an organization. There's no harm in clearing things a little bit before they're actually necessary to avoid some type of a contact. So,
Trey, could you go back to that slide for just a minute? I got a question in regards to the presentation as you move forward.
Sure.
Which part of it is you identify places as just beam. And so I was wondering what portion of the line is considered beam canal and what portion is, I mean, it's almost like I think there should be some mileposts on this thing. So people, when we talk about a specific area, there would be a map, whether it be every 10 miles, 5 miles, 15 miles, whatever it may be, to better identify the areas.
Yeah, so a little later in the program, there's some quantities of acreage per those smaller sections. And then you'll see kind of toward the end, I kind of try to narrow it down into just the three lines, the Swan, Tai, and the STI, because I think it's very easy for people to visualize that. How we manage within those particular lines, you might bounce to one area that has higher vegetation growth or the other. But so in this process, we've also tried to somewhat simplify it as well. And for the reason you just explained, Bob, it's pretty hard to show it on here per se. And at the end of the day, as far as the overall management of the plan and how much acreage you have to cut, I guess it's not super salient to them.
Yeah. So what I'm understanding, looking at this map, and Swan is the blue, beam is the red, and
The STI is the red.
Okay.
The Swan Tai intertie. So that goes from Swan Lake up to Tai, and then Tai all the way to Petersburg. So right now you're just seeing the three lines that I referenced.
Okay.
Earlier.
Okay. Yeah, we're just trying to narrow down because when you put beam, it looks like it's such a large area. I just wondering if milepost or something would make some sense, but that's an internal thing more than anything else.
Yeah, and I don't have those exact numbers in front of me, Bob, but happy to provide all the spreadsheets for all. We've actually broken this down for every single section, from each pole, what's there, what kind of vegetation, potential growth rates, when was the last time it was cut. And so we're getting down into that granularity for the plan purposes. I tried to bring it up a little bit higher. So
No, I appreciate that. I'm just saying that for future board members, if you say that we were doing something on X part of the line is between milepost 50 and milepost 75 or something. I don't know. I'm just taking off the top of my head.
Yeah, that's a fair enough question. And, I think I'll stop on page 82, and I'm just kind of roll through this little highlight just a couple of things. It, just for a reminder for some of the board folks that may not be super familiar with our line, we have 175 miles of transmission line. And Robert, if you want to roll to page 80. On these little highlights here, then we have about 2,000 acres of right-of-way that we've got to cut. We have 1,129 structures, and 90% of the brushing requires helicopter access. So these are just some quick reference points, key information about our system. And with regard to the purpose and need, I think it's always important to identify, why are we doing this, right? And, and it, first of all, it gets down to safety. It's employee, contractor, public safety. And then the other bigger item, or I'd say not bigger, but more broad, would be system reliability. And without good clearing, not just on our transmission lines, there's also some elements in here that talks a little bit about our substations and other facilities that we also have to clear. For example, dam abutments, those require a special team to come in and do clearing. So there's a number of areas that require, this vegetation management, if you will. So we already talked about the map, and this is kind of a general reference. So you can see Petersburg and Wrangell and the Tidy Power Plant, Swan Lake Power Plant in Ketchikan. And like I mentioned earlier, that traverses about 175 miles. And I think I'll kind of draw your attention to page 85. And I'm skipping through this pretty fast because if I spent time on each page, we'd be here all day. So, but what I wanted to highlight here is in the top table there, it reflects how many acres we have under each of the three lines that were shown on the map. And if you look at the next table a little further down on that page, this represents the grand total of acreage on the far right column there that we would have to cut if we're going to be on a 15-year cycle. And recognize the average vegetation clearing plan that for utilities is usually 5 to 7 years. And which I think is probably too aggressive for us, and certainly we can't afford it. But also recognize that our transmission lines are tall. And a lot of the vegetation management plans for other folks, you know, include distribution and things like that, where trees tend to be a lot closer to the line and impinge on the line a lot quicker. But what this is essentially showing is that, you know, we've on an annual basis have cleared about 70 acres. And really to try achieve a 15-year rotation, we need to increase that up to 135 acres a year. And this is where you see also, Bob, where you mentioned earlier, you could see the BAM Canal and Bell and Cleveland and Forgotten and all that stuff. And in a couple of more pages here, we'll kind of aggregate that down just into the three lines to keep it simple, if you will. So if you roll to the next page right here, this is essentially a graph, I'll say, generated off the data from the previous page. And the different colors indicate the lines and represent the amount of acreage per those lines. And with the current data we have, you can see this is kind of we work a certain portion of one line 1 year, but we really don't need to cut it for a few years down the road in some other sections. So this kind of depicts on how we might stage brushing contractors and crew to do the clearing that's really necessary to achieve the plan. And right now, if we don't increase our investment, we're going to fall really far behind, and actually we'll have outages just because we'll have trees growing up into the line. So I think with what we know now and the data gathered over the last few years, we have a lot better handle on what's required to have a sustainable plan. So that particular graph was based on cuts scheduled by area. And then the next graph is a simplified graph that essentially is a sustainable cut schedule by line. Orange being Tai'i and green being the Swan line, and then blue being the STI. And you have representative acreage there that's also highlighted in that. So I'll pause there just for a second if anybody has any particular questions to this point, and then we'll get into some of the costs and such as well.
So as I look at that, and you're talking about cost in a minute, I just, in generalized numbers, you were talking about how much it costs to clear an acre, and the fact that we got well over 2,000 acres, there's an $11 million liability there over
a period of time. So, yeah, I see where this is a big issue in regards to budgetary amounts and how we fund it. So thank you for that.
Yeah, and I think the whole exercise of putting this together has been very beneficial to better inform us and the board that, you know, this is an issue and we need to be proactive. You don't want to get behind because then it's really expensive to catch up. And if I recall, before my time here, I guess there was some history that on the first clearing of the Swan Lake line that I think that they funded almost the whole clearing of that whole entire line at one point. And it was a large sum of money. And you know, we don't want to get into that. And the whole intent here is to create kind of a levelized plan that, you know, we can reasonably forecast the investment every year on how we maintain things. So the table below that is, as I previously noted, you know, there's some other areas that require clearing. And I will note that we do a portion of the clearing with our in-house clearers. And most of that, you know, most of this is on a seasonal basis. You know, in the higher elevations, you just can't do it in the winter, and it's certainly not efficient to do it then. And you have weather, and then you have limited daylight hours, and the safety elements are significantly higher risk during the off season. So we supplement and use contractual labor as well. So if we move to page 91, I'll talk about some of the associated costs and such. So SEPA currently budgets approximately about $300,000 annually for internal brushing operations. And well, that includes the wages, load of labor, all that for one FTE for the brushing crew and then a seasonal person to assist at that. And then we also spend on average about $350,000 for contractual vegetation management activities. And the in-house labor, we tend to use them on the, I'll say the onesie twosie, smaller get in, get outs. For a quick example, you know, we'll have them go cut trails in to get to the towers that are, that were scheduled to do an inspection on that year. So when our a line contractor comes in, they have a clear pathway. They can get in, get done, get their work done. They'll go in and clean out helicopter pads and things of that nature. And then we use the contractual labor to come in and do the large swaths to really mow down big acreage, if you will. And currently, the cost of per acre for contract clearing is about $5,200 an acre. And I think, you know, those costs are obviously going to escalate up over time. And so we're going to have to figure out, you know, we're going to have to slowly make adjustments over time. The one thing that increasing our contractual clearing acreage per year will do for us is we'll be able to put out maybe restructure our contracts, our RFPs. And, you know, maybe we'll get a lower rate overall because they might be a little bit bigger contractors because the MOB and DMOB costs play a big role in that as well. So at the end of the day, in order to achieve the 135 acres on average, with what we know today, it's going to cost approximately another $350,000 a year. Just to increase that acreage. So, you know, and of course, you know, we have lots of challenges out in the field for folks that haven't flown our line. You know, it's really remote. It's probably some of the roughest terrain for line clearing in the state. Very steep, very rugged. You know, it's mountainous environment. You have a lot of fog. You have rain. Everything's wet most of the time. So just very challenging. And of course, you know, you still have, you know, infrastructure that you have to be careful around as well. So you don't damage it or get somebody hurt. So, certainly a lot of things that, that come with this. And we go into a little bit about, you know, how we, you know, what are our clearing objectives, how much we cut, and how big, and all that stuff. But I won't get into that clearing guidelines too much right here. But suffice to say that they're in your packet. And of course, you know, we have obligatory notifications and stuff for clearing. And we also have regulatory compliance. You know, there are some under NESC and such that have some requirements. You know, you have to responsibly clear your line or you can be liable in some ways. And I'll say it, I kind of opened this whole thing up for one of the my main objectives when we started putting the plan together. And an underlying element of that whole thing was without a vegetation management plan, if we have some type of a large loss on our line, let's say that our line causes a fire or something of that nature, and then there's maybe some federal funding that comes in to support that. If you have a vegetation management plan in place and you are following it, then those FEMA funds can often flow a lot easier to your organization. And there's, if you don't have an established vegetation plan and you're, you know, essentially, you know, a vegetation plan is following best practices. And in SEPA, we always try to follow best practices. So this is just another one of those elements as well. So with that, I'll just pause here and happy to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, go right ahead.
I have a few questions. I'm assuming that they'll be pretty easy answers if that's okay.
Yep.
Great. So I guess the first question I have, Trey, is who authored this plan? And then is there citations that are included with the information provided within that we don't have available to us here within the plan?
So I'm not sure what citations you're looking for other than we did cite the statute from the regulatory compliance element. But we've established, you know, looked at lots of different plans. We've had general guidelines for clearing for years. But I mean, this whole authoring of this has been an aggregate of, you know, Clay and boots on the ground collecting data to feed into the plan. I mean, there's massive spreadsheets that back up this plan with all the data behind it and every single section and stuff. And that's probably a little too much information for the board packet, just from the deliberative process and how we go about it. But, and then the rest of it is, I think more informative, laying out how we do things. And if you look at vegetation plans, there's wide variability across, even just across the state of Alaska, if you will, but certainly across the U.S. So there's no real hard and fast standard, if you want, to go by. So you have to create a plan that works for you, that works for your area. You know, and frankly, some of the new technology has allowed us to improve our approach. I don't know for most folks out there, if you've ever tried to gauge how far a tree is from a line, it is extremely hard to do, especially in varied terrain. Very, very difficult to do. The advent and implementation of GoPros mounted to helicopters and being able to go back and review that data as opposed to just flying the line and, you know, and trying to observe, oh, that looks like a, you know, high spot and stuff. So I think that's helped. You know, from a vegetation type, that information is just kind of is readily available online. You know, how fast does a pine tree grow compared to an alder, you know. So some of those are just kind of basic assumptions.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's basically kind of what, so it's in-house and no external peer review, and the specific sources and or information provided within are just generalized research. Does that sum it up?
I would say so. I'd say that a lot more thought went into what you're implying.
I apologize. I'm not implying that no thought was put into it. I'm just saying that it was performed by in-house staff.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have any outside source do any kind of peer review, and that the information wasn't sourced within. It was just, I'm not trying to say that there's a lot of work in here, and I understand that. I was just trying to understand where all the information actually came from.
Well, some of it's a good portion is from direct observation, right? We went out, filmed, we put boots on the ground. You know, we've taken documented clearing records from the past on all the sections of lines. So it's an aggregate of data, but a lot of it's, you know, field observation firsthand.
The next question I have is review period for the plan. Do we have I didn't see an objective for review of the plan.
The board can take as much time as they want to review it if there are certain elements that they don't think are accurate or appropriate.
Let me rephrase the question. Do you guys have a period in which you would update the plan? Let me ask it that way.
Oh, for periodic updates?
Yes.
So this plan, in within the motion, there's some provisions in there that allow the CEO to update the plan along the way. And I think that's important for the simple reason that this is essentially a living document. Every time we go out and cut, we feed that data into the spreadsheet database that's behind this, and we'll obviously review it and then we'll update it periodically to make sure that we're on track for our sustainable plan. This is our best effort at this time, but it's clearly a living document.
In the plan, we taught reference in-house staff.
Mm-hmm.
Is that project staff, or are we talking about staff that are specifically trained in vegetation management and or clearing, like bushing people, bushing staff?
So the references to hiring or utilizing in-house staff, that just is specifically referencing the folks working in the field, which we currently have a brushing foreman and a seasonal about a half-time FTE brush clear.
So it's just to be able to utilize non-contract labor, however you guys decide, however we have staffing set up at the time. Because, you know, we're moving in the future, that might have to increase, right?
So
eventually.
We've had discussions in the past, Jeremy, before you got here, with regard to the in-house brushing crew, the effectiveness and the scope of work that they do, the risks involved with that. It's a very one of our higher risk element for the company. You know, I think they serve an important purpose for handling these smaller items that, you know, we can just deploy them to the field, or if there's an area that needs immediate attention rather than putting out an RFP and bringing a whole team down from potentially Anchorage or Juneau. And we've had some luck here locally at the local level too, getting some local contractors to do clearing, which has been great. But for the most part, no, it's just those guys and what they do.
Just for clarity, I said bushing. I meant brushing. So
yeah.
I apologize on that.
Well, and in the plan, I've kind of morphed that over to say tree clearing and brushing as well, because it's really a clearing program. It's not brushing. I mean, we clear trees too, and you know, so overall it's a vegetation management and a full scope of vegetation management, right down to, you know, how do you clear the alders if they're starting to grow up in your in your substation or your fence line or your access roads. You know, it really covers all elements for that.
Two more really quick questions and then a comment, and I'll be out of everybody's hair on it. In the plan, we talk about a 15-year sustainable cycle. Do we anticipate that if we happen to go into a cycle and say, assume that the clearing isn't as the requirement isn't as high, would we scale back on funding for that particular cycle or for that particular segment of work, or would we push forward into the next element of work?
So it's okay to cut a little early. But it's not okay to cut late.
Right.
So I'd rather put in a sustainable plan and get us back on track so we feel comfortable that we're addressing everything in a timely fashion and that we're a couple of years ahead of where we are actually getting up into the lines. So if something happens, and we for some reason had to stop clearing, whatever reason, a big pandemic or something might happen. You want to have enough of a cushion that you could absorb that. And that's what this sustainable plan is designed to do over time. You know, we may find as we track our clearing and go out and validate our assumptions on the amount of acreage over time and how the plan's actually performing, you know, over the next 5 years or so, there may be an opportunity to ratchet that back, or we may say, you know, things are growing faster than we thought too.
Sure.
The reality is there's such a high variability on each individual section of line. It's very hard to estimate. And so it's our best estimate at this point.
Perfect. And then I noticed on page 13 of the plan, which is 90 of our packet, that there's a picture of a landslide at the lake. I'm assuming that this plan does not and or is not addressing any tree clearing or land clearing around the lakes. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
I think that was more or less put in there to illustrate that we do have landslides that slide under our lines.
Yes.
And we actually have to deploy crews out to clear those lines. We had one up on the Forgotten Line here, maybe 2 years ago now or a year and a half ago. And we've had that a couple of times. So that's what that illustration was. But you are correct. It does not include clearing around the lakes.
And then I guess my last comment was, it's just a generalized comment that if this actually is our management plan, that without any additional appendices, that the graphs that are showing on page 9 or 86 of our packet and then page 10 or 87, that it would probably be nice to be able to have these in a grayscale printability so that if this isn't printed in color, that you can still make a distinguish or evaluate what these different sections are without color printing. Just a comment.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know if you print it in black and white, there might be enough difference in it that you can tell, but okay.
Do you mind if I make a comment, Trey?
Jump in.
So we mentioned we had 2,000 acres. And let me just do a new share here. And so, you know, 2,000 acres times on average 5,200. If I can get this thing to not annotate anymore.
So 10.4 million.
5,200. You guys, I mean, so what you're seeing here is, you know, you got a big number. So the vegetation management plan, you know, the STI hasn't really had that much requirement. Trey mentioned that. It hasn't been much because it's only been 12, 13 years or whatever. And so now that's coming into fruition. And, you know, is that 10 million dollars every 10, 20 years, 30 years. That's what the spreadsheet did. That's what they did the work on. to find out, okay, what growth rates are where. Alders grow faster, and but possibly they might be in areas that don't need to be cut. We have tall lines, short lines. We have, so when we see all those different sections, those are all delineated based on, you know, when's the last time were they cut? How often should they be cut? And Trey's point was it's to be updated or at least evaluated year to year. So we have to start somewhere. This is where we propose to start. It's reasonable. And it prevents us from having to do, like Trey said, man, that swan line is expensive. Well, yeah, when you go and try and do it all at once, first of all, it ain't going to happen in a year. And second of all, it can be pretty expensive. So keep ahead of it and then keep the outages. Those are more expensive than anything. You start adding those up, those add up quick. So anyways, that's my comment.
Thank you, Robert. So, where'd you go?
We're still here.
Okay, now we did that. It bumped me into another screen. So with the cost that is associated with adding more acreage, it's interesting because, as you said, a quarter cent is about $400,000. So just to manage the vegetation management plan over the next 15 years would take about a quarter of a cent of our sales rate.
True story.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
When I'm looking at this, I understand that this is going to translate into additional appropriations as we move forward into the future. But this in and itself is just a plan on how we're going to move forward with clearing. Is there a way to define in general, I missed it here, of whether or not there is cost of clearing. It's on page 91, that there was a discussion of in-house versus contract labor, of how this plan may impact the in-house component, or is the in-house component going to be sufficient to be able to execute within this plan?
So I can comment on that, Mr. Chair, if you'd like.
Go ahead, Trey.
Okay. So as is perceived right now, and as we're estimating to do this additional acreage, I foresee doing the additional acreage. These are typically the large swaths, and it's most efficient to bring in a contractor to do that, and that's how it's proposed here. I will note on the last sentence under that clearing cost, you know, funding will be reviewed annually during the SEPA budget process. So this is something we'll talk about because we talk about the funding for the brushing crew, and we talk about, you know, how much we're going to allocate for contractor clearing as well.
Thank you.
And I think that in-house versus contractor, this is seasonal work. You do it when the weather's good. And then if you didn't have the work schedule to keep the in-house people, if you were to hire more crews busy, you'd be in a hiring and layoff situation every year. So I think contract services makes a lot of sense.
Well, we are experiencing challenges in that already, you know, with seasonal labor. It gets harder and harder to get people that, you know, first of all, have the skill set to do it and are local for a seasonal job. So it is challenging already.
Anybody else?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
This is Carl. I just wanted to acknowledge how much work went into this plan. I think it's great. This was a ton of work, and so I think it's a good job. I see this issue as extremely important. We fight this in Petersburg every year, all the time. And one of the blessings of living in a rainforest is things grow fast. And you know, to have this type of a plan moving forward is excellent for the agency, and I support it. My questions were mostly geared around the flexibility of the plan. And I think the excellent questions by Mr. Bynum have created that dialogue to answer all my questions. It really appears that we've got a starting point for a plan to make sure that we get around and address all the areas that need it. And there is some flexibility for Trey to call an audible every year if there's something that needs to change and an area needs to be addressed sooner or later than what's in the plan. So I think it's great. Great job on this. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you. Anybody else? Hearing and seeing none, we do have a motion on the floor. Sharon, would you please call the roll?
I will. Skillings?
Yes.
Hagerman?
Yes.
Prysanka? Bynum?
Yes.
Severson?
Yes.
And four, we do have a quorum.
I'm sorry, yeah, Sharon, did you call my name?
I did, yes.
I apologize, my internet is horrible. Yeah, I vote yes.
Thank you.
Brings us to item D, consideration and approval of resolution number 2021-081, adopting the communications plan.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move to adopt the communications plan resolution number 2021-081.
Second.
It has been moved and seconded. Trey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this particular item is an item that was identified in the strategic plan as a priority for the board. And I'll say it, I wrote it about four times. It wasn't an easy plan to put together when you start getting into it. And I guess for starters, you know, we're a super small staff. You know, essentially the communications plan is me getting out and trying to accomplish these things and then, you know, delegating some other duties to staff as they're available to help. So you kind of got to look at it in that context. We have very, very limited resources, but I did attempt to, I think, cover all the critical areas that the board was interested in, I hope, and I'm looking for some feedback and on this and if it hit the things you guys were really wanting to try to address. And you know, so I guess I'll just kind of open it up a little bit, you know, to see if there's anything that you want me to address first, or I can walk through the plan. It's really up to you guys.
I think go ahead and walk through it first, Trey, so we have the best understanding of it at this time.
Okay. So, you know, I always like to start off with a little background, how we got there, and I did already mention the strategic plan meeting in February of 2020, and I, right prior to that meeting, I put out an initial plan to improve some communications, in which was well received by the board, and this was kind of building upon that. The you know, SEPA's kind of in this unique position that, you know, we have to balance the perspectives of the individual communities we serve. But we also try to speak to broader regional initiatives and, you know, so trying to balance all that. So, you know, we're not getting too far ahead of folks, but also we're communicating well and, you know, and working well with our community partners. So, I always like to put out some goals and objectives on what we're trying to achieve, with that plan and, you know, and so there's a quick list there and, you know, the first priority, which I think I addressed in the earlier improvement plan was, you know, how did the board of the members get, you know, maintain, awareness, be well informed and get timely updates, especially on emergent issues. I think we've done a good job addressing those things and, you know, and then our regular communications and some of this, well, I'll actually say most of all these things we're already doing And as we've come across gaps over the years in certain areas, you know, we've, I think, made strong attempts to correct those and have implemented changes where needed. You know, there's some stakeholder engagements, and building goodwill and trust among the stakeholders. You know, and I think this is important, you know, because it serves us. You want to build those relationships and support before you have problems rather than trying to do it after, you know, in a good example or rate increases in droughts and things of that nature. We also want to, you know, be an educator in ways that, you know, we educate stakeholders about SEPA, what we do, the value of what we bring. And the board had mentioned during the strategic planning that they were interested in, you know, career pathways for locals especially. And of course, that's a difficult lift because we don't have the local training required for our industry here. So, but I talk about it in the plan. I'll get in here in just a second on how we achieve some of that. And hopefully that addresses some of the board's concerns. And I think it's important, too, that, you know, that we, one of the other goals and objectives was to, you know, show that we care and give back to the communities that we serve. And I'll add that we serve and live in as well. So, and then another objective of the communications plan overall is to encourage stakeholders to visit our website. So, so I list a long list of tactics and probably, you know, email, text messaging, direct outreach via phone, interpersonal, virtual meeting platforms, which I'll linger on that one just for a second. One of the priorities that the board was looking for is for SEPA to implement new technologies and on meetings and stuff. And it just so happened that the pandemic happened or started in full force like a couple of weeks right after our meeting. So, you know, it didn't require much work on our part because the whole world just moved to virtual platforms and it's, you know, widely accepted now. Case in point, we're meeting today virtually. You know, trade conferences, and which trade conferences are important in, I think in some ways are even more important today. And we'll talk about it a little bit later today, but in our hiring efforts, the job market is extremely hard to make contacts with people and attract them to your organization. So there's some opportunities there. And, you know, we put this communications plan together. I did with the intent of trying to make it applicable, you know, and have some durability, not just focusing on the time of the pandemic and COVID. And so you'll see I try to touch on all the opportunities, you know, building relationships with the local press. I think we've done pretty good with that over time, although there's quite a bit of turnover in the various communities. Every few years, there seems like there's somebody new cycling in, and sometimes it's every year. So ambassadors, I highlighted that as one. I think it's important to highlight that our board members are some of our best ambassadors, along with our staff. And there's a lot of opportunity for the board to help bolster the image of the agency in the communities. And you may even consider, you know, how can our member utilities or the community, their representative communities help in that? I think there's very high value in positive messaging in your communications channels about SEPA. You know, to say positive things about SEPA, you know, being your provider and such, it is invaluable. It's one thing for us to go talk about ourselves, but to have our member utilities talk positively, I think that's hugely beneficial. And and sometimes that that messaging hasn't been super positive in the past. So I think there's lots of opportunity there. And that goes with some collaborative messaging opportunities as well. And social media, I briefly touched on that a bit. You know, getting back to we're such a small organization. And at the core of that is when people have issues, they tend to migrate to the website or the Facebook page of their distribution entity, not SEPA. But with that said, I think there's an opportunity with our website to provide additional information, but we clearly don't have the staff to have an Instagram page or a Facebook page or any of that. And really, I think the end users, the customers out there aren't driven to us for that information. It's usually their local provider. So then I go on and talk a bit about key messages, and I won't read through all those, but I think there's just a lot of good things that we're doing there. You know, we've established various taglines, you know, communities working together to keep electric rates low, you know, those type of making every drop count for efficiency. There's lots of positives there that, you know, we try to merge into our communications to have a positive effect. And then I discuss a little bit about special circumstances and, you know, how we prepare for that, you know, crisis management and how is the agency prepared, you know, to deal with that, whether it's, you know, having delegation of authority lines clearly established. You know, perhaps having pre-written press releases, or at least having a clear understanding of the delegated staff, how those things are approached. You know, single point of contact, control of messaging, and those type of things. And then, of course, you know, managing some of the big changes. Those typically take you know, repetitive messaging. And a good example of that is, you know, leading up to the rate changes. You know, we've talked about that multiple times over the last 2 years, so it's no surprise now to anybody. It shouldn't be anyway. But I attempted to address that as well. And then I get into some actions and kind of highlight, you know, what we're doing in those areas and how we're approaching those. Those include board essentially all the things I've mentioned in the earlier part: board communications, member utility communications, stakeholder engagement, building goodwill and trust, communicating the value of SEPA, promoting hydropower, career pathways, community stewardship, and website traffic. And there's some elements within those that I go on to talk about later with you know, how do we measure? How do we know if we're being successful? And, you know, are there any areas that we identify along the way to improve? And I talk a little bit about budget. And, you know, I think that's something that's reviewed annually. We don't spend probably as much time as we should talking about, you know, how do we make donations and things of that nature. I'll say the board's instilled a trust in me to, you know, handle that in a, you know, fair and reasonable way. And I think we've done a pretty good job. You know, it's always challenging. Once again, being a regional entity, we make every effort to treat each member community as similar as possible with regard to those type of contributions. For instance, you know, if we put a banner up at the high school or the local field, you know, here in Ketchikan, then we'll also reach out to the other member communities and see if there's an opportunity to do something similar. Maybe it's not exactly the same, but we do try to balance that as much as we can. Then just have a few other things in here where we talk about you know, some of the specific values of SEPA and I would hope that some of these items on the table, especially on page six, that, you know, these are some easy talking points for the board, right? Go back up a little bit there, Robert. There you go. About communicating the value of CEQA. Now, a lot of people don't know, you know, what we do or even why we were formed. And I'm, you know, as ambassadors, I think there's great opportunities to communicate some of these important things that we do. A huge one is risk. We took a lot of risk off the table for the member communities and utilities to do with, you know, capital investment, repairs, and you know, the submarine cable is an example. Another one would be, you know, investment in a new project. You know, it's a heavy lift for anybody. But as a regional organization, you know, we stand a better chance to do that with and minimize the impact for the greater good of the region. You know, of course, water management, we take the lead on that and have weekly meetings. And, you know, we do load growth estimates. You know, we also add a whole bunch of ancillary services that most people that aren't in the power business may not understand, but certainly people can relate to voltage stability or, you know, if you're back in the day, you know, when you used to have lots of dips and interruptions where they were potentially having appliances fail and things like that, you know, those things are pretty much minimized now, and CEQA plays a role in that as well. So anyway, I think there's some positive elements identified in here in some pretty good detail as a reference guide. So I think I'll pause right there and you know, solicit some feedback. Is this what the board was looking for, or did I totally miss the boat? Or
thank you, Trey. Anybody have any comments?
Sure.
Yes, go ahead.
First, I'd like to say I think that Trey and staff have been doing many, many of these things, and this really just documents, I think, what they're already doing, and I appreciate that. And I think it's a value for us. It's a value for us to be getting the so you know kind of updates and the email communications, the one-on-one phone calls, community interactions. You know, Trey's out there in the community at events and representing CEQA well. So I think that this just codifies what we're already doing. The one thing I didn't see in here, and I don't necessarily think we need to include in here because it's something that is part of the communication strategy that's in here, is having Trey and or one of his staff members come to present at the new council meetings and the new borough assembly meetings here in Ketchikan the good message of CEQA. And I know that that they've done that in the past. I just wanted to make it as a reminder of something I think is valuable for those elected officials that are new to get the 101 of what CEQA is, how valuable they are to the community, and why we want to have good relationships in the community from our community leaders with the organization. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else? So, Trey, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think that we were looking for something, at least out in writing, to get us an idea of a plan going forward, because actually CEQA is probably one of the best untold stories we got around. I mean, it's been very successful in what it does, and it does it very well. The one comment I may have is the fact that the city of Ketchikan has sent information back to Southeast Conference about potentially having Southeast Conference here in Ketchikan next year. And if that were to happen, Southeast Conference is scheduled to start next week in Haines. And if we could make sure our schedule works out, I think it would be interesting if we could have our board meeting around either end of that, and then maybe participate by having a meet and greet or educational thing, an ice cream social or something for the event, because there will be most of the mayors and administrators and other people involved in the economy in Southeast Alaska present. And I think that we could be a model to a lot of people how things work and how the three communities work together in regards to providing cheap power. But just as a thought, we have our meeting now and this one's next week. So if we tail down to the end of that somehow, because a lot of us may be attending Southeast Conference anyway. So
mm-hmm. That's a great idea.
Anybody else? Hearing and seeing none, we do have a motion on the floor. So Sharon, would you please call the roll?
Sievertson?
Yes.
Skillings?
Yes.
Hagerman?
Yes.
Kreisanka?
Yes.
Bynum?
Yes.
Thank you.
Brings us to item E, consideration and approval of SEPA 2022 Administrative Employee Group Benefits. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move to renew the Enrica 2022 Employee Group Benefit Plans and Administrative Employee Benefits as presented.
It has been moved and seconded. Trey, would you want to run us through this, please?
Sure. We have to do this every single year, and there's usually a pretty short timeline from when we receive the information and we have an opportunity to bring it to the board, and then when it's due. The deadline for group enrollment is September 24th. I'll say within this presentation, under this motion, there's an element that we're requesting to change a little bit of the wording on the ineligible classification. It used to include the CBA, but we wanted to read that the employees covered by the collective bargaining agreement to reflect the employees hired under the CBA may not necessarily be union. So it's just a small language change that reflects that people working under the CBA now don't necessarily have to be a union member, and it used to say union member. So just one clarification there. That's the reasoning behind that. That's included. I think the escalation in rates isn't a big surprise. It's kind of in line with what's been happening over the last several years. There's some things that, and there's a breakdown in here that shows the various rates and what the cost is for premiums.
So Trey, can we go back to that section of language where you said that they don't have to belong to the union?
Sure.
So are you suggesting that if an employee comes to work for SEPA and they choose not to belong to the union, that they fall under the NERECA plan?
No. This is to clarify so they don't default to it. Because the language, and I want to see if I got the language correct here. So SEPA's health and welfare plan lists employees' classifications that are not eligible to participate as part-time, temporary, and union employees. The last ineligible classification will be changed to read employees covered by the collective bargaining agreement in lieu of union employees, because it's just it's a little nuanced there. that we want to make sure, just because they opt out of paying dues and don't want to become a member, that they don't default and come onto our plan. We don't want that.
That's what I was asking, and I'm in agreement with you, so thank you.
Okay. Sorry if I didn't explain that clearly. And if you turn to page 106 there, Robert, the next one, there's a little table there, and it says, shows 2021 budget and 2022 estimated. I'll just point out on this, we didn't do any escalation on wages, so just so you guys could see what the impact of the benefits change is, you know, and it would be presumptive for me to put a difference in the wages, but you can clearly see on the health and welfare and the retirement what the overall impact of the organization would be with the changes that are currently proposed in this plan. The health and welfare would go from $263,000 to $286,000. Retirement would go from $446,000 to $454,000. Obviously, that'll skew up a little bit if there's any changes in the wage structure.
So, Trey, as I look at that, and if I utilize those numbers, just so I got a good understanding of it, the benefit package to our employees is about 38%. Is that rough figures about right? Falls within.
As far as the total loaded labor?
Yeah.
Kay, you want to weigh in on that?
It'd just be the basic math there, which I haven't done, but yeah, hold on just a second here.
About 39%, which is about right. I think that's what
that seems reasonable.
Yeah.
I would add, just for clarification, the way that NRECA, the way that they administer their benefits, I do a report to them every November 15th, or I actually do it in October, but it is a report where I tell them what the employees' wages are, what their salaries are, their base wages as of November 15th of each year. Next year's benefits will be based on those November 15th salaries.
Okay.
So any increases in wages, potential increases, would not be necessarily reflected in premiums next year. It would be the following year.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead, Jeremy.
I was just going to ask Trey or Kay if they could give us just a brief, very brief overview of 457B deferred comp and then the retirement security plan component of this and the benefit that's actually being provided to the employee.
Sure. So I guess I'll start off real quick. So the 457B plan, very similar to, comparable to a 401k plan, works about the same. So SEPA contributes currently 3% of the base salary to administrative employees only. And they only do it after that employee contributes 1%. So that one's pretty straightforward. The retirement securities plan, that, I mean, there's a formula for that. Kay, do you recall that formula off the top of your head?
You mean as far as what the benefit ends up being?
I'm not sure. Or what are you looking for specifically there, Jeremy?
I just wanted a better understanding. On page 1 of 2 or page 107 of our packet, the benefit is based on 2% of participants' final average effective salary. subject to the vesting. So is that?
So the vesting almost the vesting is on a 5-year schedule where you know start off first year that you participate, you're vested at 10% and it goes up over 5 years. If you're over age 50, you're automatically vested 100% anyway.
That's on the 2 of 2, correct?
Yeah. And the 2% is, I believe, on the average of the last 5 highest years, or the last 5 years that somebody is employed.
Is that a 2% per year of service?
No.
No. Okay.
I really would have to dig out the calculator, and they have a little table where you can estimate what your actual benefit would be from that. If you go down a couple of pages, there's a billing rate history page for the retirement security plan. Yeah, that right there. So this is a 2% benefit. It's an age 62 plan, which means it's based on retirement at age 62, and it has a COLA. You can see the average ages there. That affects our premium to some extent. But there again, once you have an average age of over 50, it really doesn't change much as far as premiums go or contributions.
I'll simplify my question a little, make it a little simpler. Trey, do you feel that what we currently have listed here is an equitable retirement component for our employees? Or is this what we have here based on what we've just always done and what we're constrained to by our finances?
I think it's a very fair and equitable program. It's a very stable plan. It's well funded. The benefit is good. I think, in fact, I'll take it even one step further. I think it's a very important aspect of our benefits package that is a great recruitment and retention tool. I think the retirement benefit calculation is, I think 2% times your average high five times your years of service or something like that. It's pretty simple formula.
Yes. Thank you.
So I guess if I may, Trey, so what we're saying is SEPA is paying about 5% into the employee's retirement split between the two programs, even though they're in a little bit of a different formula.
Sorry, Bob, I'm not sure I followed you on that.
Yeah, I was just trying to get an average cost for SEPA for paying those, the combined 3% and then the 2% that we're looking at here.
Yeah, so your 457 is capped at a certain amount, right? Does that get back to your earlier comment, Bob, as far as like the 38-39% total cost of the?
Yeah, I'm just wondering what we're paying. I mean, if you had that guy making $100,000 and you're doing this plan, what are we putting into his retirement plan a year as SEPA? Just out of question. Comparative cost type things.
Is that going to be $40,000? Okay.
Yeah, it would be the, yes. Well, wait.
I'm looking at the bottom of page 105 on the percentages. right there, the defined benefits plan, the RS, and then you got three, so it's like a total of 43.49. Is that correct? In Bob's scenario of 100K salary, for instance.
Yes, that is correct.
So we're putting 40,000. Is that
We're contributing 40. If it was just straight up 100,000, and the contribution rate there is 40.49. That would be 40,500 a year.
So we're putting 40,000 a year into their retirement plan as. For an individual employee making $100,000.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yep.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure I was clear on that one. I thought that's what I was looking at. So I think that's and there's a vesting period by which they have to vest before they can draw upon that. Is that right?
5 years and then 62 to draw the full amount.
Okay. Thank you.
And there is also a 1 year waiting period. If you're a new hire and you haven't already participated in this plan, say at a different NRE, at a different location that has NRECA, the same benefit, there's a 1 year waiting period before you get to participate in the plan.
Yeah. All right.
So I think the only other part mostly that we haven't touched on was, on page 107, it does show that the, SEPA employees do make a contribution toward their own healthcare, 10%, which we started a couple of years ago. So we've got some skin in the game as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think... Were there any other questions pertaining to any of that?
Mr. Chair, one other quick question. I just want to verify, Trey. So when we see increases of the way that we're currently doing our cost share, when we see any increases in our cost of medical, the employee is holding this formula the way it is now. So SEPA is picking up 90%. The employee is picking up 10.
That's correct.
Okay.
And sorry for my video. I got a high window here that's shining in here.
No worries. Yeah, I think that's great. And I just wanted to make sure that there isn't any escalated cost to the employee for escalated cost to the organization.
Yeah, it's just a straight split.
Yeah, there is. So yeah, the 10% employee goes up as well.
The employee goes up. It's just an even split. If it's whatever it is, it's an even split as predicted. It's 10, not even, I should say. It's 90-10.
90-10, right. So yeah. I brought it up as recently the city had explored this, and they had split that additional cost with the employee. So the employee's rate wasn't equitable like this. They ended up picking up half of the additional cost.
Mm-hmm. Of the increase.
Correct.
Gotcha.
So I just wanted to make sure that wasn't the case here.
Nope.
I think that was a way of working on, in some cases, some cost containment for the city, and because you're dealing sometimes with you're always dealing with a situation where you have no control over the costs in regards to what they're going to charge you. Just keep going up. So thank you for that, Jeremy. Thanks, Trey, for the explanations. Anybody else? Hearing, seeing none, we do have a motion on the floor. Sharon, would you please call the roll?
Bynum?
Yes.
Sievertson?
Yes.
Skillings?
Yes.
Hagerman?
Yes.
Kreisanka?
Yes.
Thank you.
Bring us to item G, consideration and approval of sole source contract.
Oh, no. I got consideration and approval of the R&R project budget increase. I have a motion.
Chairman.
Yes.
I move to approve R&R project's potential transformer Tyee Lake and transformer circuit switcher Wrangell substation as presented in the September 9th, 2021 board packet and an increase to the fiscal year 2021 R&R budget of $16,600.
Second.
It has been moved and seconded. Trey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Item one, the Tyee potential transformer, the cost of that was met the threshold for our capitalization program. So that's why we're adding that to the budget. And the transformer circuit switcher, it does not actually affect the FY 2021 budget, but we're going to add it. We'd like to add it as an R&R project because it has very long lead time, and we'd like to expedite that.
Thank you. Any comments? Hearing, seeing none, Sharon, would you please call the roll?
Kaisanka?
Yes.
Bynum?
Yes.
Sievertson?
Yes.
Skillings?
Yes.
Hagerman?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That brings us to item G, consideration and approval of sole source contract to Southern State for Wrangell substation transformer circuit switcher equipment. I have a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move to authorize staff to enter into a sole source purchase order with Southern States LLC for SEPA's Wrangell substation transformer circuit switcher R&R project for a total not to exceed value of $261,244.
Prasanka, I second.
It has been moved and seconded. Trey?
So follow on to the last item on the agenda. This is a request from staff to authorize us to go ahead and make this purchase. So lead times maybe 6 months or more. And so we want to get it rolling. And it's a sole source request because Southern States is the vendor of the in-kind equipment. And we'd like to stick with that. There's a provision in section 8.4 of our policy, procurement policy, that allows that. And that stuff is cited in the memo. It's an important piece of equipment, and it's got a long lead time. And there you go.
All right. It didn't look like $261,000.
Yeah, we could have got a better picture, I think.
There's three of them, and they're big. That was just showing you that it's out of gas. Showing you the gas gauge on your boat, Bob.
Yeah, that's an awful expensive item. Are there any other questions?
Mr. Chair, brief question.
Yes.
This is the procurement of the circuit switcher in and itself. In the budget item that we have listed here, the total estimated cost is $401,300, and that includes the installation. Is that going to be, that's going to be performed under a separate contract, or is that going to be performed under contractual work that we already have in place?
Well, first of all, that will be performed in the next budget year. That's why it's not included here.
Okay. Roger, I got it. We're moving the procurement up because of the time constraint, as you'd mentioned.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Hearing, seeing none, Sharon, would you please call the roll?
Hagerman?
Yes.
Kaisanka?
Yes.
Bynum?
Yes.
Sievertson?
Yes.
Skillings?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bring us to item eight, discussion, demand side management. Trey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I added this here just for a discussion. This was something that was identified in the strategic plan. And And specifically, it said in there to provide an evaluation of demand side management program that runs in parallel with power contract efforts. In parentheses, studies, load forecasts, and community input is needed to make a recommendation. So, you know, when I started digging deeper into this, I guess a few items that have to do with demand side management. First and foremost, SEPA really has no control over demand side management because we have zero contact with the end user. We don't have any way to influence that. And frankly, I don't think the member communities would appreciate us stepping in and trying to influence the demand of their customers. So for the most part, demand side management is typically addressed through the distribution entities. If there's, if our distribution entities, namely the member utilities, you know, have a demand side management program and there's some way that SEPA can help in some way, I mean, we have to recognize that SEPA has very limited resources to do this type of thing. And, you know, most utilities have a dedicated person. That's all they do, right? They go out and put programs together for putting in heat pumps and, home efficiency measures and, maybe hot water heaters and all those types of things. And, you know, SEPA really doesn't have the ability or the interaction with the end users to do any of that. So I just wanted to bring it to the board's attention. It's something that was identified in the strategic plan, and I really don't know what my deliverable is here or how I even go about it. Acknowledging that, you know, the strategic plan is just a plan and we developed it, you know, pretty quickly over about a day and a half. So there's always items here that we need to circle back and maybe revisit and at least clarify some expectations here. So I just wanted to open it up for discussion and to see if I was missing something or didn't fully understand it.
Thank you, Trey. Anybody have any comments in regards to that? Yes, Jeremy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I concur with everything that Mr. Atkinson just said. I think that one of the things, take a step back from a member utility perspective, that if I was looking at TSEPA, I'd be asking the question of, are there demand side management targets or goals that the SEPA would like to see the member utilities achieve? And that way we can have a better conversation about how that may impact the organization. So to rephrase it differently or say it more clearly, I think SEPA's role in demand side management would only play a role in that we would be trying to define a specific target of what we're trying to achieve from SEPA's perspective and then communicate that to the member utilities as it would be their mission then to achieve that if at all.
Thank you, Jeremy. Yeah. Ray, do you have a response to that?
Yeah, I've got a little bit I can add. So, first of all, I think it's going to be variable individually per community. And I think where the conversation started is if our region was aggressive with demand side management, we could potentially delay construction of a new project for a period of time. I don't know what that is. And so to give you a simple example, if I was running one of the member community utilities, I would say, well, let's do an audit. Let's see how many people are on electric heat. And then I would do an economic analysis to determine, well, how much does it cost to transition somebody to a heat pump? And then how much would I have to incentivize them to do it to get a payback on my end by not having to take on additional debt service to build another project? That's kind of the way I would look at it. So I think there's opportunities, and you kind of have to look at your own system and see what your customers are doing and how you might lower their loads. But I also have to be very sensitive. I mean, we've had member utilities that say, well, we're in the business to sell power, not to reduce sales. So, like I say, that's why I'm trying to just kind of suss out what, you know, what my role is here and how we might help. But I mean, that would be one of the reasons why you would do it, right? Our grid system here is way different than, say down to the Northwest, where you have, you know, the Bonneville administration or something like that. And they actually get, you know, potentially incentives of cheaper power, if they can get their customers to use less power during peak periods, for instance, because of the spot market. We don't have to deal with that as much here, but some of it could overlap a little bit, and there might be some opportunities there. So that's just kind of where I was coming from, and probably the catalyst of some of our earlier discussions on demand side management. And you know, and it's, I guess it's you know, there's some reasonable reasons to do that.
Thank you, Trey. I know that at one time we were discussing the fact that the cheapest kilowatt is the one you don't have to build for. So if there's a way that you can do some of that. So when you get to that break point where you're having to start considering debt service for bringing on a very large cost to the organization to build another hydro facility someplace, and the long-term cost, I guess those costs, of course, would be passed on directly to the communities. And so it's up to the community to decide, well, if I do some demand side management on my side, I can hopefully fend off that for a while. Or if we are reaching our peak at spin at the peak times, if there is some efficiencies we can gather to lower the peak demand, and then not have to bring on another machine even, that makes some sense. But if it's costing you more money at a time to ramp up a bigger machine to provide a small load, is there something else we can do in regards to demand side management?
You made a very good point there, Bob. A perfect example is, let's just say, one of the member communities is looking at their backup diesel resources, and they're going, wow, we're right on the edge here on peaks for, you know, a handful of days during the winter if it's really cold. And they're looking at, well, should we go make the investment of, you know, put your price out there, $a few million to install an additional genset, or does it make sense to incentivize somehow, at least understand your loads enough so you can say, well, wow, we've got, you know, half a megawatt of electric heat. You know, if we incentivize these people to get off this and take some other thing, then we wouldn't have to make this big CapEx investment over off to the other side. And so I think you made a great point there, and there's a direct correlation on, you know, just the individual communities could save money on their backup diesel and their approach anyway.
Thank you. Yes, Jeremy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick follow-up. My understanding is that this item was really brought up, as Trey said, is because this was something we did have in our strategic plan. I feel that this is something that kind of sits in the parking lot until we really need to address it. And it's really the responsibility of the member utilities to be communicating with SEPA about what that demand might be going moving forward in the future, and staying in good communication and good, being in good touch with what's happening in the community in the future, load growth that may occur, when it's going to occur, how it's going to occur, and then work in partnership with SEPA to deal with demand side management when we see that coming.
Yeah. All right. Anybody else? All right. Now a discussion only. So let's move on to item I, review and discussion of CEO's evaluation form and schedule. Joel, can I drop this to you a little bit in regards to how we got to the evaluation form?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're, this has been a multi-year process that several prior boards have been diligently working on to kind of get it a little more routinized. And, you know, this, you know, I think since this board only meets four times a year and it's subject to new appointments at the end of every year, it's nice. And I think prior boards have emphasized this, that really, this board this year ought to be the board that evaluates the CEO on an annual basis. And just as a reminder, in the contract with Trey that the agency has, is a requirement that he gets reviewed every year. And I think, don't want to speak too much for Trey here, but I think, you know, he likes to have a review and know where, you know, how he's doing, how the agency's doing, things like that. And it's just a good due diligence practice to do this. So I think, Trey, this is something that we put together before the schedule, I think, something similar. And then we have a form that gets sent around that I think, Mr. Chair, we've used in the past. In fact, I think the original one is what is really something you put together a few years ago. I've used it actually for other clients as well. So I think it's a nice form. And the idea is that it gets circulated, probably have a special meeting follow up once everyone's filled it out. And that could be an executive session to have a discussion about performance of a public employee. And then, you know, all the decisions are made and then usually the chair or vice chair sits down with Trey separately and, you know, discusses the progress, the actual review itself.
Thank you, Joel. And so as you see on the board right now, there's a schedule for that evaluation. So the third quarter board meeting we're at inserts the prior year CEO evaluation and board packet for review. Discusses modifications, I guess, in regular session, what we're doing here now. And if no changes to the form are adopted by consensus, if modifications are required, then SEPA staff will modify them. 2 weeks after the third quarter board meeting, SEPA staff distributes those evaluations for the directors via email for completion. So it's really important that we all sit down and take some time with this and go through it to make a proper evaluation out of it. And it's fairly comprehensive, and I think it's a good avenue by which we can have an open discussion with Trey as we talk about his evaluation and performance and potential pay. And then we do that, and of course we'll provide the deadline for the return of those forms. And then we have a committee where that comes back to for the council and the chair starting privilege and confidential communications in the subject line of the email. So then SEPA Council is to perform a checklist to determine whether all directors have submitted the evaluations and communicate with the board to follow up with any
anything that may or may not have been submitted by the deadline. That's 1 month after the third quarter board meeting. And so then by November 15th, the deadline for the SEPA council and the board chair to complete the evaluation in preparation for the December board meeting. So at that particular point, all those informations would be correlated into a presentation and given back to the, I think, the board members to evaluate as we move into the preparation for the board meeting. And that would be with all the directors at the time we do that. So 1 week prior to the fourth quarter board meeting, SEPA Council will distribute those compiled evaluations to the board via email under privilege and confidential communications in preparation for the CEO evaluation. And on the fourth quarter board meeting, the evaluation will go into an executive session where the board will discuss, usually before inviting Trey in, so they get a consensus, and then they will invite Trey in and we'll go through that evaluation process. If I remember in the past, we had a board, our members that worked directly with Trey in regards to moving through this process. I think actually Cliff sat on it and Bob Lynn may have sat on it, if I remember right. I'm not sure.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
I think the big point last time was, is as Joel confirmed too, is the length of time it took for us to get anything back to him. And I think that's the point that we want to take as a board, is that we want to be a little more expeditious in getting this out the door quicker, because Trey sat for quite some time before the evaluation came through.
So with that, I think that these timelines should be hard and fast, and so that it moves forward, as Cliff had mentioned, in a timely fashion. So we're doing our job and providing Trey with the expedience of getting this done. So yes, Jeremy.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to reaffirm that what you just said is that this was approved by, adopted by, consensus of the board in September of 2020, and that these are hard and fast deadlines that we have here. With that being said, when this is being provided out, will we have specific dates also attached to these?
Joel, those communications will usually go through your office. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, the reason we have them through my office is just for confidentiality purposes.
Right. Correct. So
I gather it's really just administrative, but it is the sole purview of the board of directors to review its CEO and not mine. I'm happy to help facilitate in all ways.
So I think that it's at 2 weeks after the third quarter board meeting. We could potentially get those at any time from now until we have to have them back. So and if we get them back earlier, we may be able to even move this timetable up for some of the things that we have to do. So where that 2 weeks after the third quarter board meeting is the target, if there's no additions or corrections that have to be made, I think they can come out prior to that. And then the board should complete those as detailed as possible.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So my question is, when this is sent out, will it be sent out, or can it be sent out with the very specific dates that aligns with these 2 week windows, 1 month window, so that when we get this in our request, we know specifically the date that we have our deadline on this. And then also,
we can attach that.
Thank you. And then my second question is, in here, it only indicates that we are providing the evaluation form. If there's a request from a member for last year's evaluation, would that be on special request, or will that be sent with this?
I think we did send that out last time, did we not, Joel?
Maybe.
I think we did because we wanted to, there was goals and stuff set in the last time. We wanted to make sure we met those, and we had to compare those and that type of stuff. So
yes, with Trey and Sharon's help, we will attach materials from the prior year.
All right. So were there any corrections, additions, or anything else that any board member wanted to make to this particular form? All right. So if we work with those deadlines and we get in a little earlier, then we would schedule or potentially could schedule a special meeting via Zoom in executive session to where we can have open discussions about the individual forms.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Yes.
So when I look at this, this was approved. This was what the approved plan was. If we're looking at wanting to do something sooner, this would this constitute a change? And then would we have to amend the language to provide that provision?
I think that can be done at the call of the chair. If we have the information prior to the date and deadline and we compile those documents, I'd be at the call of the chair, we could move the schedule up. Would that be right, Joel?
Yeah. I mean, I think it was assumed that this was adopted, but this is just a recommended procedure. So, you know, I think we can all be flexible on this to make sure that it meets the board's needs this year, and those needs change. So, yeah, I agree with you.
Sounds good. So are there any changes? Hearing and seeing none, we're going to utilize the form as it exists. So the next thing I would expect is that we would have these mailed out with a potential attachment so we can start with the evaluation as individual board members. And then a month from now, or when we get them back, Joel, you'll go through the checklist to determine whether all directors have submitted the evaluation committee with the board chair and myself, or whoever that's going to be me at this particular point in time to follow up with in regards to those deadlines. Then by November 15th, we will compile all that stuff.
Get it back out, yeah.
Yeah. And we could potentially somewhere in there, if we wanted to hold a special meeting in regards to discussions, we can do that. Once they have all the information in hand.
Yeah, you may want to, just so that it's not.
I think it would be a good idea.
All crammed at the end of the year. I know, I'm sure staff has, you know, will have a huge number of items to get through at the end of the year. And maybe we'll all be together and we'll have some place we want to go after the meeting. So, I'd probably recommend that process. And in that, I'll make sure to gather last year's materials, here while you're looking at filling out the form this year.
Sounds good, Joel. And you'll give me a call if there's anything you need from me in regards.
I will. Thank you.
All right. So I think that we've reviewed and we've looked at the schedule and we've discussed the potential modifications if time allows. Is there anything else?
Not
so,
thank you.
Thank you. So we have item J, which are the executive sessions, and we did add item 7K, which is the appointment of secretary and treasurer. So with that, the executive session, do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move to recess into executive session to be conducted pursuant to SEPA's bylaws consistent with Alaska Statute 44.62.310 for discussions relating to hydrosite analysis and potential interconnections to Metlakatla and CAKE, as the discussions will include matters the immediate knowledge of which would clearly have an adverse effect on the finances of the agency and the projects.
Second by Prasanka.
Thank you. It's been moved and seconded. Is there any discussion? Seeing and hearing none at this particular time, Sharon, would you please call the roll?
Bynum?
Yes.
Severson?
Yes.
Skillings?
Yes.
Hagerman?
Yes.
Prasanka?
Yes.
Thank you.
So Robert, it'll take you a little bit